Case number 22-7110 et al. International Union United Mine Workers of America, Appellant, James Asbury et al. Versus Consol Energy Inc. and its wholly owned subsidiaries et al. Mr. Fagan for the appellant, Mr. Woodrum for the appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors. Kevin Fagan on behalf, the United Mine Workers of America. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttals. There are two issues before this court. First issue is respect to vacatur and how the district court got the decision with respect to vacatur, correct? The second issue is the standing of the United Mine Workers of America. District court decided that the union lacked Article III standing, constitutional standing, to pursue its confirmation of the underlying arbitration award. I'd like to focus, please, on the vacatur argument initially.
I think maybe we better to start with
the procedural issues
and then a couple additional questions that we asked Council because we don't get to merits issues unless we get
certainly,
to this threshold.
Certainly, Your Honor, my oversight there. Three questions were posed to the parties on Monday, and we thank you for doing so in advance of this argument. The first question posed was the standing of the subsidiaries to press their cross appeal, seeking vacatur of an arbitration award to which they do not appear to be a party and by which they do not appear to be bound. It's the UMWA's position that they are indeed a party to this RA decision and that the record evidence establishes that. The subsidiaries were signatory to the 2011 collective bargaining agreement. That collective bargaining agreement at Article 20 requires them to develop an employer plan, an EBP, employer benefit plan, which provides lifetime health care benefits to union retirees. It did so through the plan administrator, Consol Energy, parent company. In the district court phase in the Southern District of West Virginia, Judge Faber found that the Consol Energy was indeed a plan administrator, was in fact and indeed signatory to the collective bargaining agreement. And quote, the court finds, in fact, indeed, Consol Energy was an agent of the subsidiaries, none of whom have employees or other personnel adequate to make administrative decisions.
Did you say Consol was a signatory?
Yes, Judge Faber.
Is there a list of signatories not including Consol?
Pardon me?
Isn't there a list of signatories at the end of the agreement not including Consol?
Judge Faber found that they were signatory to the collective bargaining agreement for a few reasons. Number one, their chairman, Mr. Nicholas Deolius, was the chairman of the BCOA, the Bituminous Coal Operators Association, which is the multi-employer group that negotiates on behalf of its members. Mr. Deolius also signed certain side letters of agreement appended to the collective bargaining agreement. And based on that, Judge Faber found that Consol Energy, parent company, was a signatory to the contract. Yes.
I think what we're talking about is who was a party to the arbitration and against whom does the arbitration award run?
Well, Judge Faber found them to be the real party in interest.
I'm going to ask you a direct question. Is anyone other than Consol Energy named as a defendant in the arbitration?
Well, the RA decision itself speaks to the subsidiaries and speaks to the fact that Consol Energy was appearing on behalf of the subsidiaries.
Where does it say that?
It says so. Let's see. Under jurisdiction, Your Honor, going to appendix 375. Respondent acts as the plan administrator for certain subsidiary companies that were signatory to the 2011 NBCWA.
Respondent acts as the plan administrator for certain subsidiary companies. The respondent is the plan administrator, Consol. Maybe acting, but I don't. Is there an agency finding in the award?
Yes, there were.
In the award?
There was an agency finding by Judge Faber.
I understand. That was after the fact. The finding by the trustees.
I don't think there's specific finding of agency.
Finding. So the respondent is the plan administrator console, not the subsidiaries.
I'm getting a little feedback. I'm sorry.
All right. So find yourself to the arbitration itself in that award. The named respondent, you all picked who that would be, and you picked Consul. They were sending the letters. I understand why. You picked Consul and Consul only as a plan administrator.
That's correct.
And the award runs against Consul Energy only.
That's your construction, Your Honor. We would disagree.
As you know, with arbitrations, we don't really... We take them on face value. We don't add to them or subtract from them. So where is it the finding in here that anyone other than a plan administrator was the named respondent to this arbitration?
Your Honor, the conduct engaged in, which gave rise to the dispute between the party, was all in Consol Energy letterhead on behalf of the subsidiaries.
I'm going to ask again, this is just a factual question or content question. Point me to the language where the arbitrators found that, in fact, notwithstanding how you all framed the arbitration, there was the subsidiaries themselves were named respondents and are bound by this award.
They are not named in the award. That is correct.
Okay. And then is there any case authority that lets us, you're arguing that there's an agency thing or, the real party in fact or something like that. But is there any case authority that federal courts, either under the MLRA or I guess if we have a Federal Arbitration Act case, we can think about it, can rewrite the award to say it runs against entities who are not named?
No case law that says that they can rewrite the award.
Well, we have to take the award as given.
Certainly.
Back again to how they stand for their counterclaims if they are not a party to the award or the arbitration?
Well,
can't be enforced against them.
I think you can't make that determination without considering the status of the subsidiaries. The record establishes that the subsidiaries, Judge Faber recognizes, had no administrative, they had no administrative construct. They were a shell company.
None of that's in this award. None of that's in their decision, trustee's decision, or the award. So is your point that you wanted to use the confirmation process to not just confirm the award, but then make sort of factual and legal determinations about against whom the award legally operates?
Your Honor, we would argue that Consol and the subs are the same.
I understand you would argue that.
And I am arguing.
Can argue that all day. But you've also agreed that the trustees made no such finding.
Discussed the employer, and the employer in this decision is
Consol. The trustees made such no finding. When you confirm this award, you're confirming it against Consol.
Yes, but
why do you want to be bound by this award? It's adverse. Sorry? Why do you want so badly to be bound by this arbitration award?
We want the subsidiaries to be bound, Judge. Because they've undertaken a contractual commitment to provide lifetime health care to our retiree beneficiaries.
This award was filed by an employee, and the grievance he filed was affirmed. The arbitrator said, yes, employee, you are right. And so we're going to issue this award binding the respondent, which, as Judge Millett has pointed out, and as you have conceded, is the plan administrator, right there, page 375. The respondent, singular, acts as the plan administrator. And just to be clear, the subsidiaries were not plan administrators at this time, right?
No.
Consol was the only plan.
They let their parent company, I assume the parent company dictated the sub.
Here's an award adverse to the plan administrator. It's not adverse to the subsidiaries, but you seem to want the subsidiaries to be bound by an award that would be adverse to them.
The trustees in this decision, in effect, enjoined plan administrator from making any post-contract changes to the level of benefits. Of course, we want that to apply to Consol's own subsidiary.
Are they the current plan? Who is the plan administrator since Consul disappeared 6 years ago?
That's a good question, Your Honor. As far as we could tell, there was a series of restructurings. We think the publicly traded entity known as Consol Energy is the plan administrator.
So not the subsidiaries.
That's correct. And if you look at the record,
if we were to substitute in the replacement, the successor plan administrator, it would not be the subsidiaries. It would be Consol Round 2.
It would be the successor to the plan Consol, administrator,
not the subsidiary.
The subsequent plan administrator. When Mr. Salvatore, who's the HR director of Consol Energy, was asked in his 30B6 deposition whether the subsidiaries had any personnel or had any ability to administer these plans, he said no. And he said that is done by our corporate parent.
Right, so subsidiaries have no ability to administer this plan. You just said that.
They have.
And so they can't. What do you want from them? They're not the ones administering it. They're not the ones that can make the change or the console that no longer exists was threatening.
Certainly. We want the injunction, basically, that the Rod trustees developed to apply to the signatories to the contract, the subsidiaries.
You should have named them.
Who are all out of business, by the way, Judge. And they only operate, as Mr. Salvatore admitted, to administer its lingering, their residual contractual commitments, one of which is...
Do this through this entity, you're assuming they're doing it through this entity that we'll call Consol 2 or whatever, this new entity that's nowhere in the award, wouldn't be bound. I mean, I'm a little confused about why we're supposed to confirm an award against an entity that doesn't exist.
Well, Your Honor, if the court deems that there's further factual finding that needed on that issue,
First we're trying to figure out whether, because your the subsidiaries have filed counterclaims.
That's right.
And we're trying to figure out whether they have Article 3 standing to have done that.
And that's right.
And
I wouldn't presume to speak on behalf of Mr. Woodrum and his client.
You began your argument by saying you think they do have standing because you think they're bound by this agreement.
But we absolutely have maintained that throughout this litigation, that the subs are signatory, they had a plan administrator. They obviously speak to one another.
Do you have any case? I just don't know under the LMRA. Are there any cases that say a labor arbitration decision against an agent automatically encompasses and binds the principals?
Judge Faber, in his footnote 12, says case law further supports this court's previous ruling. He cites a case finding a single employer where interrelation of operations, common ownership, or centralized control of labor relations are present. J.R. Ryan v. Sons.
That requires factual findings.
I understand. When the charges against a parent company and its sub are based on the same facts and are inherently inseparable, a court may refer claims against the parent to arbitration, even though the parent is not formally a party to the arbitration agreement.
Mm-hmm.
That's set forth in his decision.
Right, that's a different question about whether Consol, whether Consol can be named here as a party to the arbitration. But we take that as given.
With all due respect, and I mean this with all due respect, anyone in the coal field, nobody ever says, hey, I'm employed by Helvetia. We never received a letter from Helvetia. We didn't receive a letter from Laurel Bond Mining, mm-hmm. Aminati. Never received
it. Great factual evidence.
Everybody who works for Consol knows that they work through Consol through what used to be Scores subsidiary. Mm-hmm. Consol is the real party of interest here. And as I stated previously, Your Honors, if there's a dispute about that or if you're not convinced of that, perhaps there needs to be additional fact finding in that area.
Okay. And then there were two other questions about the way this case was
not avoiding the question.
No, you're not. I've distracted you with a question.
The second question is under what authority did the district court dismiss counts 3 and 4 of the subs counterclaim? As I initially indicated, Judge, I would defer to Mr. Woodrum. It's his counterclaim, and I wouldn't deem to speak on his behalf. The third question.
Well, you have filed an appeal from what you, I think you assumed was a final judgment. So why were you convinced that you had a final judgment to appeal?
Well, what we tried to do when we met, the court initially remanded this case because there was summary judgment and the court said, you don't have a final appeal. So what we did do is we went back to the district court and Mr. Woodrum and myself and Judge Nichols, we worked to try to prune the case, to try to delimit the issues as much as we could. And we did that in undertaking in good faith. I don't know why Mr. Woodrum decided to take a dismissal on those two counts. I do know why we decided not to file additional summary judgment motion with respect to counts one and two.
Mm-hmm.
And that is because the count one and count two both asserted that or Consolidated Energy was or the subs were asserting that the Rod trustees did not have the authority, to decide a dispute. In essence, Your Honor, an arbitrability determination.
The subsidiaries filed five counterclaims against you, correct?
That's correct.
And claims three through five, the district court said they are dismissed and they've been voluntarily dismissed. Am I right so far?
Correct.
Okay. Under what rule of civil procedure did the court take that action?
Well, it doesn't, the ruling, as far as I can recall, does not speak to Rule 40. And I understand that the entire action was not dealt with in Judge Faber's decision. But I will speak to the last question that was posed to the union, Your Honor. And that is
just before you turn to that one.
Sure.
I'm looking for a number. Sorry,
you go ahead and answer.
No, please.
No, if there was a violation of Rule 41, is that itself jurisdictional, though? Or is that just district courts people argue all the time that district courts violated 12b-6. But that doesn't mean there's not a final judgment, just if there was a procedural misstep, right?
The rule says what it says. I would defer to the court's judgment on that rule. In fact, the entire action was not disposed of in the Rule 41 motion, and it was under the auspices of a court order. So the second provision of Rule 41 would apply. This is jurisdictional. I'd like to say it isn't. I don't have a case to point to you right now.
Lots of Supreme Court precedent from this court that we don't treat every violation of a rule or a statute as having jurisdictional consequences, defining jurisdictional consequences, unless it's very explicit. This rule is not explicit. So maybe there was a mistake, but
I think what happened,
whether there's a final judgment here, the district court said it was in complete control, entered an order, said it's a final judgment, wrapped up everything, disposed of all claims, maybe mistakenly disposed of a claim, but we hear appeals all the time from people who say the district court mistakenly disposed of a claim, but there's no doubt the district court was in control here and wrapped everything up in a single final judgment.
Yes, and I think Mr. Woodrum, and I'll speak on behalf of myself, what the union certainly did was look to the judge's September 30 decision, wherein he found two things. He found that the dispute was arbitrable, right? And he also found that it drew its essence from the collective bargaining agreement. He would be the second federal judge who found the dispute to be arbitrable. Because before Judge Faber can enter his order enjoining the company from further changes in compelling arbitration, a predicate to that is the finding that the dispute is arbitrable. So I think that the parties were laboring under that understanding.
That was a preliminary injunction.
Sorry, Judge?
Preliminary injunction.
That's correct.
And was there any factual finding or conclusion with regard to arbitrability? It seems to me it was sort of a standstill.
I believe a reading of Judge Faber's decision of March 17, 2017 reveals that he found the dispute to be arbitrable.
Did you say that?
They were likely to
and
succeed.
He compelled arbitration, Judge.
Compelled arbitration.
Compelled arbitration.
Right.
But it
would still be for the arbitrators to determine whether it was arbitrable.
Well, typically the courts decide arbitrability unless there's an explicit agreement and there's it's unambiguous. There's no ambiguity with respect to that issue. But the trustees, so here we have belt and suspenders.
You didn't have that kind, did you have that kind of language here, or was it for the district court to decide?
We have language that says in the collective bargaining agreement that all disputes arising under Article 20 are under the jurisdiction and purview of the Rod trustees. So I would argue, yes, we do have that language. And I think Judge Faber independently...
That count as a type of unambiguous language that allows the arbitrators to decide it, or was this arbitrability for a court to decide?
I think
it has to be unambiguous.
I think that the language of the contract is unambiguous. I think that the Rod trustees...
What did the district court judge find? Did he find that it was his decision whether it was arbitrable and that was a decision he was making? Or did he find that it's for the arbitrators to decide?
He didn't preface it, Judge. He just found it that they had the authority to render a decision with respect to the dispute. Now, under the collective bargaining agreement, Article 20 is finally...
I think to issue a preliminary injunction, you also had to find that you were likely to succeed on your arguments.
Right.
That
he also had to
find that you were likely to succeed on your arguments.
And he also had to find imminent harm, harm that still persists to this day. So if you take Judge Faber's decision the day before he issued it, okay, we're in the same posture we were then. This company, CONSOL Energy, acting as the plan administrator of the subsidiaries, communicated on four occasions to our retiree group. Two of those occasions, they said, changes are in the offer. Okay? We filed the Rod procedure. We filed the injunctive action on December 23, 2016. The ink wasn't dry on that injunctive action before CONSOL Energy again reached out to our retiree population. And this time, they didn't say changes may be in the offing. They said changes have been made.
Those 2017 letters were not within the scope of the arbitration. 2016 letters were. Right?
No, no. All letters preceded the arbitration. The arbitration award in this case.
They got the filing of the grievance. The grievance was done, you said, in December 2016.
Oh, that's correct.
The grievance encompassed those two communications from 2016, not the communications from 2017. You might have thrown them in for window dressing in your case, but that is not the scope of the grievance. Can the trustees expand the scope of the grievance?
Well, they certainly considered all the community.
I'm just asking, can they and did they extend the scope of the grievance?
Well, the question posed to the Rod trustees may have been based on those letters, but the question posed and articulated by the trustees was whether the respondent could make post-termination changes to the health care plan. But they had nothing to do directly with those letters. Now, of course, they did consider this second batch of letters, and I think this is extraordinarily important for standing purposes. On January 12, 2017, CONSOL Energy, on behalf of its subsidiaries, sent what's called a summary of material modifications to retired coal miners with healthcare issues, an aged and vulnerable population. And they set forth four parameters. They said, this notice is to inform you that of effective January 1, 2017, 11 days before, the plan listed above was amended. They made two ministerial changes. They changed the name of the plan. They excluded certain companies that have gone out of business. But here, and crucially, they said the administration section was amended to take into account the expiration of all relevant bargaining agreements, thereby eliminating the ROD process. So by fiat, they told our retiree population that there was no more ROD process. And in fact,
I understand that letter. I've seen the letter. The trustees did not address changes to the arbitral or the decision-making process, the dispute resolution process. They addressed, threatened, in your view, threatened changes or proposed changes to benefits.
That's correct.
And that's what the injunction was, that no change in benefits.
No, benefit levels. The Rod dispute process.
So that did that enjoin?
Well, there was
changing the plan resolution, dispute resolution process?
Well, this one letter just speaks to these changes. They also required that if the plan administrator was unable to resolve the dispute, any disputant would have to file a lawsuit in the Western District of Pennsylvania.
That's not what I'm asking. I'm asking, you're here on confirmation of an arbitral award. And the arbitral award was focused on...
I was going to get to the changes.
Okay, well, I'm just trying to get right to it because I don't understand. I'm not here to talk about their changes or asserted changes.
They can't make changes to the plan. That includes changes...
Where does the award, let's go back
here,
say they can't make any changes
to the plan? The award, opinion of the trustees, pursuant to Article 20, et cetera, et cetera. Trustees have the authority to adjudicate the ROD. The trustees recognize that the respondent may make modifications or changes to the health benefit plan for which it is the plan administrator after the expiration of
the or changes in the employee benefit plan. Is the dispute resolution process in the employee benefit plan?
Is it dispute? Yes, it's part and parcel of part
of the employee benefit plan. Where is it in the? Okay, we have the model employee benefit plan in front of us. Where is it?
It's set forth in the model benefit plan. It's set forth in the employer benefit plan.
What page?
It's set forth in the collective bargaining.
No. Maybe other places. I'm talking about what the trustees were dealing with here. What page? I just missed it then when I was looking at it in the.
Just a moment on the model plan, Your Honor.
J471. A few pages after that, where does it talk about the dispute resolution process?
Yeah, 472, administration. And this basically echoes what's in the contract. Plan administrators authorized to promulgate rules. The trustees of the health retirement funds will resolve any disputes, et cetera, et cetera. Any disputes. And that's echoed in the EBP, and it's set forth in the collective bargaining agreement as well. So not only can they not diminish the level of benefits, they can't just by fiat say there's no more ROD process. The ROD process is a crucial administrative component of the employer benefit plan. It's been extant since 1978. It's been final and binding on the party since 1981. From our estimation, we believe CONSOL Energy has been party to 9 agreements since that language has appeared in collective bargaining agreements. The ROD trustees also did something else that's of significance, Judge, and Your Honors. What they did is they reviewed the contractual language, the employer benefit plan, the model plan, as you indicated. They considered the submissions of the parties. They considered the injunctive hearing, and they also considered previous ROD decisions. One of those ROD decisions, tellingly, was a post-expiration ROD decision. Now, under the terms of Article 20, ROD decisions become precedent. They become part and parcel of the collective bargaining agreement. The ROD decision issued by the referenced by the trustees, ROD decision 88-711, was post-expiration. Okay, since the issuance of that, CONSOL Energy, its subsidiaries, none of the CONSOL family of companies have made any effort to negotiate a change in that. So any claim that the ROD process does not survive the termination of the collective bargaining agreement is belied by specific contract principles of construction and certainly belied by the fact that post-termination disputes have previously been resolved by the trustees.
Got that. And so those changes in those letters never happened because you got the preliminary injunction.
That's exactly right.
And then the trustee award comes down.
Correct.
It says CONSOL can't make any changes to the
as plan administrator.
Yes, as plan administrator can't make any changes without negotiation.
Any post expiration
without negotiation.
That is without agreement.
Agreement. Thank you. Can't do that. Okay, that's who this award runs against. That CONSOL plan administrator no longer exists. The entity named and ordered not to make any changes by this confirmation by this award no longer exists.
Well, it
right?
It no longer exists in that right. form. Yes.
No, right, no longer exists.
Judge,
did you substitute in?
you need a program here to follow the players. But
not just that we need a program, is that there's sort of legal consequences to whether people are substituted or not. When one entity disappears and no one's substituted in, I mean, I didn't see anything in your third amended complaint seeking confirmation of this award that said we actually want to change the entity against which the award runs. I mean, there's one way to read your complaint is saying not just confirm, but actually reinterpret, update, change the operative target, and then confirm. Is that what you intended to do? Or did you just want this award confirmed, no changes, no adjustments?
At the time this award issued, Consol was the plan administrator.
At the time of your Third Amendment complaint, where you're asking the district court to just flat out confirm, don't touch anything, don't do anything, don't say anything, just confirm. Or were you asking in your complaint for the court to first make clear that this award runs against either the subsidiaries or, which you now told us at argument, is this new Consol entity?
We think the form is sufficient, and here's another try. Another try, Judge. The trustee said no changes to the plan administered by Consol Energy. Exactly.
It said,
but the contractual.
It said Consol, no changes to the plan.
To the plan, which the subsidiaries, which applies to the subsidiaries' contractual commitment to provide benefits.
What good? I'm just not understanding. What good is it to you? What is redress by an order confirming an award, regulating behavior by an entity that no longer exists?
Well, the current action is against the subsidiaries. So we're arguing that it doesn't run to Consol. It runs to the subsidiaries.
So you're arguing. Explain to me how this works under the LMRA. If you confirm an award against an entity that no longer exists, how does that award do anything to the subsidiaries?
Well, let's imagine that the subsidiary said, hello, parent company, we're not happy with the way you're administering our plan. We're going to substitute another plan administrator. Would this decision obtain? Absolutely. It doesn't matter who the plan administrator is. The trustees have issued their decision that no post-contractual changes can be made without agreement with the United Mineworkers.
What authority can you provide me? You do LMRA all the time. I do not. It says if you have an arbitration award confirmed against a single entity that no longer exists, that binds, legally binds, all by itself, entities not named in the award.
Well, if that were the case,
by the award,
if that
what
were the case,
can you provide me? What legal authority? Is there any such authority?
Not off the top of my head, Your Honor. But if that were the case, every adverse decision would be followed by a corporate restructuring.
Well, there's ways to write things. I mean, people do this all the time.
Right. Well, Judge Nichols, in his opinion,
against Consol and its subsidiaries, name them in the grievance, name them, have them named in the award, and then you're covered.
So I understand.
I'm just trying to understand. No, it's your. It's
I
your
understand
case.
That.
I'm trying to understand how your confirmation.
No, no.
Help you.
And it's well taken, Your Honor, and I don't mean to be combative with you, but we're talking about formalistic approaches here when, in fact, everyone and their brother in this union, it's been around since 1890, knows the Consol, its subs, and everybody at 1100 Consol Avenue up in Pittsburgh are one and the same. Everybody knows. Mr. Salvatore testified.
I didn't know that.
I didn't know any.
Everybody in the full industry.
Okay. How about that? Sorry.
And I'll tell you one person who knew it is the HR administrator for Consol, Mr. Salvatore. He testified that these companies had no employees. He testified that to that during the injunctive hearing. He testified to that 3 years later.
So I recognize you talked about the 2017 letters, but the trustee's decision said no changes have yet been made. And then the injunction made sure no changes were
trustee's
made.
Decision was made post-injunction. And the trustees made mention of the fact the changes were not made because of the extant injunction.
So there were no, there certainly was a letter that was threatening, I guess, from your members' views and your view. But there were no changes made at the time of the award. The injunction has long since expired. The injunction has long since expired by its own terms.
Yes.
And still no changes have been made in the intervening 6 years or 4 or 5 years before you went to district court here on your third.
Judge, I'll tell you why that is. I'll tell you, yes, I'll tell you why that.
Actually, that's right, though.
Correct. And I'll tell you why that is. When the UMW approached Judge Faber in the Southern District and said, hey, we want to file a Second Amendment complaint, the judge issued a, I'm not sure, I think that was opposed by Mr. Woodrum and his clients, but the judge issued a decision, and his decision was May 21, 2018. And he basically said, you know, the union wanted to include a count to continue the preliminary injunction until the court confirms the arbitration decision. At the hearing, the May 10, 2018 hearing, counsel for plaintiffs requested the court strike this count in light of defendants' representation that it would continue to offer retirees the benefits available under the employer plan until the conclusion of this action. That lone assertion is the only thing.
What page of the JA is that?
That I'm sorry, I apologize. That would be 315. The decision begins. I think footnote 5 is the Joint Appendix 315.
Sorry. The language that you were reading about they agree not to make any changes till litigation is over.
Yeah, during dependency of this litigation.
Yeah, what page is that?
I believe it's on 315, Your Honor. Wait a minute. It might be. That's where
that's the beginning of the opinion.
That's where the decision starts. It's a footnote 5. It's on page 320. So that promise, we believe, is the only thing that stands between CONSOL Energy making changes or the subs making changes to the healthcare plan, because that's the only reference in the record that they would do so. The court has it right that any changes were nullified by the injunctive decision of Judge Faber, and we believe that once this action's concluded, that subsidiaries will continue with making changes to the plan.
What's the line in footnote 5 again that you were reading?
It's I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What's the line in footnote 5 again that you were reading?
Oh yes, it's footnote 5. It's at 320. Joint Appendix 320.
What's the key line?
Oh, the key line. At the hearing, counsel for plaintiffs requested the court strike this count in light of defendants' representation that it would continue to offer retirees the benefits which they're entitled until the conclusion of this action. So
this action wasn't an action for confirmation.
Well, I take that to mean until the conclusion of this litigation. But if it's subject to dispute, that puts us in even more tenuous position. And at any point, CONSOL can say, well, that wasn't part of what we represented to Judge Faber. That's the only thing that we think, Your Honors, that stands between CONSOL making changes to the plan, the subsidiaries, I apologize, falling into my own rhetorical device here. The subsidiaries making changes to the retiree health care plan.
Kept you up here a long time.
No, thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is John Woodrum. I represent the companies in this matter. I first will respond to the jurisdictional issues you presented in the per curiam order.
Question.
Yes, ma'am.
Do you agree that this new console is the plan administrator or the subsidiaries themselves the plan administrator, or is there no difference?
My understanding that the new parent corporation is the plan administrator of this continuing plan. But the new administrator has no corporate relation to what is now known as CNX, which was the plan administrator right. During this period. These companies were as part of a larger package spun off, and they exist under a separate publicly traded company at this time, and have really since the month that the arbitration decision came down is when the restructuring occurred. So the old plan administrator has not been in that position since almost the date decision came down.
So the new plan administrator, you're here on the behalf of the new plan administrator, is that correct?
I'm sorry, sir.
Are you here on behalf of the new plan administrator as well as the subsidiaries?
No, I'm only here for the subsidiaries. The new plan administrator is not a party to the case at all.
Can you then go to the first question in the order that was asked about, are the subsidiaries parties to the 2017 arbitration award, and are they bound by the 2017 arbitration
award? No, Your Honor, they are not. And from the very time this ROD was filed, they protested it under, they submitted a response under protest to the panel, to the trustees.
So they weren't a party to the arbitration award, right?
That they were not named in it, and they specifically in their protest, response under protest, they noted that Consol Energy, who was the named party, had no employees, had never employed these people,
and they weren't bound by it. And they were not bound by the 2017 arbitration award, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Then how is it that the subsidiaries have standing to challenge the arbitration award?
Well, that's the essential question that you put to us in your per curiam order. And the reason we have standing is because, though not a party to the award very directly impacts us. We are harmed by the award because it's our plan. We did the bargaining about it. Insofar as there are changes to be made in the future, we will be the ones negotiating with the union. Yet, in the award, the trustees reserved their jurisdiction, even though we're no longer signatory to an agreement.
And I don't know the answer. It's not a rhetorical question. If you were to then just defy the award and, you know, change what the award says can't be changed, and then you get sued for that, wouldn't you have a good defense? We're allowed to make those changes because we weren't a party to the arbitration award in 2017, and we're not bound by the arbitration award in 2017.
We would certainly make that defense.
Then why do you need us to decide that question now when a court could decide that question when there's actually a Kitch controversy?
Because the award, whether if the award is not vacated, it remains, arbitration awards don't have to be confirmed in order to retain vitality. So the award itself will remain.
But you're not bound by it.
We're not bound by it, but the problem we would face in the real world is the union would promptly file a grievance with the trustees who have said that they have continuing.
I mean, it sounds like, I get that, but it sounds like you want our court to issue you an advisory opinion today so that you can use it in different disputes down the road.
No, Your Honor, we're not asking you for an advisory opinion. We're simply asking you to vacate this award. Don't pull back and say, we don't have any jurisdiction here, because the award will stand if it's not vacated. And the award itself says that these trusts, we would have to relitigate everything that we've been litigating for the last 6-7 years.
Do you have any precedent on your side that is analogous to this situation where what's happened is there's been an arbitration award that does not bind the plaintiff, but the plaintiff wants an Article III court to declare the arbitration award invalid, to vacate it, because it's having some kind of collateral effect on the plaintiff?
Not directly on point, and it's partly a function of the very strange way which this case has evolved. We found an analogous situation under the environmental statute. So there's a Fourth Circuit decision that involved harm to a downstream individual who felt that certain facility was going to pollute a river and harm it. And the Fourth Circuit said that it had standing because as a downstream entity, it could be harmed. And in our case, not only could we be harmed, we feel we are harmed because the arbitrators decided that they would, until all the retirees are dead, they have the right to resolve disputes, any dispute that comes under this plan, notwithstanding that the contract itself, the 2011 agreement, gave the signatories, my clients, the authority to amend the plan unilaterally after the contract terminated. So the contract terminated, they amended their plan to say that this panel no longer has any role in adjudicating disputes under the plan, yet the trustee's decision, panel's decision, says we do.
Could you make any of the changes you referenced in response to Judge Walker that you want to make directly, or would you have to do them through this new plan administrator? Who would actually implement the change?
Well, the plan, the companies are responsible for the plan. They are the plan sponsors. They designated.
Who makes the changes, though? Do you direct Consul to make the changes? This is the new Consul, because it seemed in the first round of all this, it was the plan administrator that was announcing the changes.
Right. My understanding that the plan is still in effect. The only thing that's changed because.
No, I'm not asking if the plan is still in effect. It's certainly still in effect for retirees that were covered by this time window in the collective bargaining agreement. But what I'm asking you is really in the first round, what set all this off was companies, employers wanted to make changes, but they didn't announce it directly. They had the plan administrator notify the beneficiaries of proposed changes in the 2016 letters and upcoming changes in the 2017 letters. And so I'm just asking whether that structure would continue now, that would you yourselves be the ones that would make the changes, or is that's why you all have a plan administrator. You tell them what to do and then they notify beneficiaries, here's what's changing.
The latter, Your Honor.
Is Consul 2 your agent?
Consul.
The new Consul.
The new Consul is my understanding. We don't represent them and they're not in the case, but it's my understanding. I've been told that the new Consul is the plan administrator.
No, I get they're the plan administrator, but what you should know is the new plan administrator your agent, your client's agent? Because the district court found at the preliminary injunction stage that the first Consul was the agent of the subsidiaries. And it sounds to me from your answer to my question that the same would continue now, that this new plan administrator, new Consul, for at least these purposes, is your agent, because that's to whom you would go. Assume there's no trustee decision or anything like that. That's how the process works to make.
I think administratively, that is likely how the process works.
The new consul is the subsidiary's agent for these purposes.
Would be the agent for purposes of handling the, making the changes in the sense of changing the plan, but it's always the subsidiary's responsibility because they have the contractual obligation. The parent, the non-signatory parent plan administrator, does not have the contractual authority to make the changes. Therefore, it doesn't have the legal authority. It would derive from the signatories themselves.
I know you and your clients have maintained for years and years that you are not bound by
correct
this agreement. But if the one it binds is just your agent, can an agent be bound but the principal not?
And this issue came up in our in Consol Energy's appeal of Judge Faber's preliminary injunction. That very issue was one of the key issues in the case. And in oral argument, the court, I forget, I think it was Judge Niemeyer, made the point that an agent binds the principal. The principal, i.e. the companies, doesn't bind the agent. So did I get that back?
Right. So if the agent binds the principal, then you are bound by this award.
The acts of our agent, yes. But the decision to make changes to the plan.
Hey, IL, crazy.
That's it.
Excuse me, I don't know what that was. Your comment was not crazy.
I need help.
It was Alexa.
I'm a ventriloquist on the side.
Right. So you can decide you want to make change, but you can't make them because if one were to assume that new consul would be bound by this confirmation word, just like old consul.
No, I don't. I mean, we're not bound to it. It wasn't issued against us.
Just told us the whole reason you have an injury is you can't make changes with this thing. This is what I'm not understanding. How can you both not be bound by it, as you said, and yet be bound in a way that injures you
because
it keeps you from making any changes?
Because the arbitration decision, though not directed to the subsidiaries, remains a valid decision at this point. It's never been vacated. It's a decision that's out there by this panel. And going forward, anything that these companies do will be challenged by the union.
You're going to argue we're not legally bound. And that if there is such a challenge, you're going to say, what are you all bothering us for? We're not, you can have your award against an entity that doesn't exist. We're not bound by it.
Not bound by it, but it does provide precedent. What's going to happen as a practical matter? And I think probably.
But precedent, and maybe I'm being too court versus arbitrator about this. A long line of people could come up in any case and say, judges, if you rule way X, that's going to bind me in the future. But they are not parties, and they're not bound by our decision, and there's no way they have article standing. Maybe they'll come in as an amicus, but they don't have article standing because we could create a precedent that could affect them in a dispute, maybe if they have one in the future.
I agree that that is a position we would take, that we're not bound to the decision. But what will happen
is going to be a pain for you.
Pardon?
It's going to be a pain for you.
Oh, it's going to put us right back through this cycle again, because the union will file a ROD with the trustees who've already said that their authority survives the labor agreement, even though we're no longer a signatory. They will file that ROD and they will go into federal court, probably in West Virginia, and get it enforced, and then we're back in the soup. The only way to prevent that and create a level playing field is to vacate what is obviously a defective arbitration decision. It's defective because it's against the wrong party or a non-signatory entity that's not subject to arbitration.
Could you make that argument to to future arbitrators? In other words, do arbitrators have the authority to overturn past arbitral awards?
This particular labor contract, as I recall, if the provision is still in there, says that prior arbitration decisions are precedential. But an arbitrator is not bound to follow a prior arbitration decision in the way that judges would be by other decisions of panels in this court, for example. So it would be, I'm sure, taken into account by a new arbitrator.
But you could persuade a future arbitrator that there were enough flaws in the 2017 award such that the future arbitrator should act contrary to the 2017 award?
Well, we would first argue that that arbitrator has no authority. And then we would
be another way to get out of it.
We would be compelled. I suspect this is the way it would happen. We would then be subject to, we'd seek to stop the arbitration, which is what we tried to do in this case in the first place. We would either win or lose on that basis. If we lost, and I think in some courts that have protected these processes, we might well, or the new, yeah, we, the companies, might well be brought back in and then be subject to an order to compel arbitration. We would make those arguments to the new arbitrator and say, in response to the union's argument that this issue has been decided, the trustees have already decided they have the authority, and it's not a general authority. It involved this plan. We can't say that, oh, that was some other company with some different plan. It's this very plan that this invalid decision purports to interpret and enforce. So we would have that burden to bear with a new arbitrator, and then we would have to go back through the process that we'd just been through in order to determine that we have the legal right to administer our retiree benefit plan according to the terms of the plan.
You don't administer it.
Pardon?
You don't administer it.
Well, it's administered by our plan administrator.
Your agent.
So I stand corrected on the technical use of that. We don't administer it, but it's our plan, and our plan administrator has to do what we tell him as long as it's lawful. So it's our plan, and therefore we...
So you said as long as it's lawful. So if you said to plan administrator, new plan administrator, make this change to these retirees' benefits, could the plan administrator do that with this arbitral award pending? Out there, not pending.
It would violate the award.
So would it be lawful for the plan? You just said
yes.
The plan administrator does what you tell them unless it's unlawful. And so it would be unlawful and the plan administrator couldn't make the change?
We would argue it's very lawful because we're not bound by the, I'm just saying, I agree with Judge Walker that...
You don't need us to do anything for you today. You already have the lawful authority to do what you want to do.
We believe so. So, but it's only lawful as long as the court says it is.
And it's your burden to show standing. And under your own theory, under your own admission, you're not injured by the current state of the law.
We believe we are injured because there
you're allowed to do everything you want to do under the current state of the law, because that one arbitration award from 2017 is invalid. So it's not actually binding you.
That's what we say.
It sounds like you're saying you don't have standing because you're not injured.
Is your injury that you're going to have to go through all this procedure, litigation procedure, and arbitration procedure again? That's the injury?
That's the injury, yes, Your Honor.
It's not an Article III injury.
Well, it's harm to us because we are inhibited by an arbitration decision that purportedly interpreted our plan, which is not, we can't be held in contempt for violating because it's not against us. But if we make a change, we are in violation of an extant arbitration award. which says that these trustees have perpetual authority to decide disputes, whether or not you're signatory to a contract.
So I'll make sure I got this. If this, your standing to oppose confirmation is clear, right? You just want to be able to actually to seek vacature in addition. Right?
We need now, vacature.
If you're not in a position to seek or to get vacature, and the court says we deny the request for confirmation on the ground that you're not a party to the award, some arbitrator later is going to bind you?
We run that risk because there's a valid arbitration award and we have a district court decision that says the trustees had that authority. So it becomes murky as to how that would turn out. We believe we are right under the law, but we would have to go through that process and take that risk again. So we are, as I said, we are inhibited from making changes because we know what lies ahead if, in fact, this award is not just simply vacated as being violative of
Judge
the trustee's
Nichols, story. At the end of his 2022 decision, says the subsidiaries acknowledge their obligation, their quote, obligation to provide health benefits to eligible retirees post expiration. Is that accurate?
We do have a contractual commitment in the expired contract to continue to provide benefits to retirees. It's sort of analogous to a continuing term and condition. So we have that obligation under the expired agreement, and we agreed to it, and we're doing it. I mean, we never proposed to terminate benefits. That was never the issue in this case, and the case wasn't about that. The only issue in the case was we wanted to provide them differently.
You wanted to change. Well, that's very much disputed whether...
Right, and that's in dispute. And we don't mind litigating that issue. We just don't think these trustees are the proper parties to hear that issue because we didn't agree that anything we do after the contract expired could be decided or resolved by this panel. We're prepared to defend any changes we may make, even under that ongoing requirement that we continue to provide. All we agreed to in the contract was to continue to provide their benefits at the benefit levels. So if we change something that a retiree or the union thinks violates that, they have other federal court remedies that they can pursue to challenge that. The only issue in this case, in this arbitration, is that these arbitrators don't have the authority to do that. And so that decision should be vacated.
Can I ask, maybe this is a more straightforward question than all this standing stuff, and that is, the jurisdictional basis for your counterclaims is Labor Management Relations Act, correct?
Correct.
What contract violation have you claimed? Because the jurisdiction is for violations of contracts. What contract violation do you say UMW did?
Well, I think the courts have held in, it's a good question, but I think it's been resolved. I think the courts have said that a suit to vacate is an action under 301. So we believe that...
A suit to vacate when there's been no violation of a contract?
It's the arbitration. The arbitration decision exists, and a suit to vacate the arbitration decision, the decision's there until it's vacated by a court. So...
If the arbitral decision was not the product itself of a contract violation, so assume for purposes of this question that there's no, if there's no Labor Management Relations Act jurisdiction over the suit to confirm because there's no alleged violation of a contract, and I think courts have also said anticipatory violations aren't good enough.
Right.
Fear that a violation could happen.
Well, it is.
Your jurisdiction would disappear as well.
It's a circular problem, a conundrum, in that
yours rise or falls with whether they've established a violation.
Right.
The Labor Management Relations Act.
Our argument is that there is a violation of the contract because the panel, an arbitration panel, wrongly decided an arbitration or an issue under the contract, which the union in its complaint is trying to enforce against us, even though we're not a named party to the arbitration, because the arbitration decision interprets our obligations under a benefit plan. So this case, that count was originally filed, I think, the day the contract expired. So we filed in Pennsylvania, and that case, long story, but it ended up getting merged in, consolidated with the union's case here. So we...
What cases say that vacature of an award by pardon? Itself, what cases, is it cases from this court or the Supreme Court? I've said that vacature, seeking vacature of an arbitral award satisfies LMRA 301 jurisdiction?
I came across it in reading. I didn't make a note of it because it wasn't an issue at that time, at least mm-hmm. until you mm-hmm. presented it
okay.
to us.
Okay.
So I don't recall
okay.
that case, but sure. there've been a lot of case reading over the years
I'm sure
in this particular action.
One quick question. If you do not have standing for your counterclaims, does that mean that there's no party adverse to the union's one count claim?
If we don't have standing, there is no party because it purports to bind Consol Energy, which is now CNX, which is not even in the frame. And they were dismissed out by Judge Nichols, and the union didn't appeal that dismissal. So I think that's correct, Judge Walker. There is no other way to get relief here.
Is there usually when there's a corporate reorganization, some entity assumes the liabilities of the predecessor entity? They can't just get out of liabilities that way, otherwise it would be really convenient. Do you know who it was? Was it CNX? Was it this new Consol? Who assumed the liabilities of First Consol?
That was a major corporate transaction. It's documented in SEC filings.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that Consol Energy would have retained some obligations. That's almost always the case.
Consol Energy or CNX?
The CNX, the entity that became CNX, the seller, if you will, retained our seller, sold us, or disposed of us, would have retained some obligations with respect. There were many companies involved, not just these subsidiary companies that I represent. So I'm sure that some obligations were retained. I don't know with regard to this specific case what the arrangement was, but there's no damages.
Possible to find out what entity took over this liability under this confirmation award? Is that something?
Well, there's no liability under the award because there are no damages. Nothing.
There's compliance liability. You said that's the whole injury you have here. Someone's supposed to.
I don't know, Your Honor. It's very difficult to measure that kind of a damage. I don't know how. I don't even know whether the parties discussed that or not.
Wow, I
know that.
Get out of injunctions just by reorganizing.
I know that the parent was certainly aware that these companies had been, they were not signatory at the time of the actual reorganization. So, but they know that they had retiree liabilities. So I think what the parties most likely addressed was who's going to be responsible going forward for payment of the retiree benefits. And honestly, I don't
but
know the answer.
Consol was the plan administrator. Why would it have any liability at all? Or
it wouldn't.
The obligations of the subs.
Subject to an injunction and a confirmation award. Subject to an injunction and a confirmation.
Well, there are many categories of UMW retirees, and the parent, not to further complicate this case, but the old Consol Energy was liable for a large group of UMWA retirees under a statute called the Coal Industry Retiree Healthcare Benefit Act. So there are thousands of those retirees.
Okay, so it was by law.
And it was by law that they were made, along with the employers, they were made responsible. So they can't, and their cases have held that they can't transfer that liability. Well, they can negotiate or get an agreement to transfer that the buyer will assume it. But in the end, if it's not provided, it would come back to CNX. These retirees are not in that position. They're not protected by statute. So it's simply a collective bargaining obligation that would determine where that liability is. And I do not know whether the old Consol Energy, I don't know who's paying retirees, how they're getting their benefits, but it was a known liability, if you will, Judge, that obligation was going to continue. So I suspect that they did have some understanding about who was going to assume it. Contractually, though, the old Consol would not have the liability because the liability rests with the subsidiaries. So in that sense, neither parent has it. It lies with the subsidiaries, but somebody is providing the benefits.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much for your extra time up here too. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mr. Fagan, we will give you 3 minutes for rebuttal. I know you asked for five, but it's been a long morning.
I can do this quickly. Thank you, Mr. Woodrum. Mr. Woodrum gave no compelling reason why this award should be vacated. This award drew its essence from the collective bargaining agreement. I think I might be repeating myself, but it reviewed the plans, the contract language, the submissions. The submissions not only of Consol, but if you look at Joint Appendix 500, you can see the submission of Mr. Woodrum on behalf of the subsidiaries under protest. The 17-page letter that he writes to the trustees objecting to the process, not to the award. It hadn't issued yet.
That's the kind of the weird thing about this award, because sometimes it talks about respondents singular, the plan administrator, but then it says on J371, the first page of the award, the respondent filed 4 responses to complaint.
Well, that's right.
We know Consol filed 0 responses to the complaint. Those 4 responses to the complaint were filed by the subsidiaries, right?
I believe that to be
right.
The case.
Right, they're called, the trustees said it was respondent that filed them. So it seems like there's times that the trustees are treating the subsidiaries and Consol as one and the same. And again, the next paragraph, in the second response, the respondent's legal counsel. Well, that was
Woodrum represented
subsidiaries. A lot of times it treats them as one and the same
for
the position of respondent when Consol didn't show up. So I'm just a little confused as to who the trustees thought they were issuing the award against when respondent singular sometimes means the plan administrator and sometimes means subsidiaries.
Right. In that March 17th letter, Mr. Woodrum makes all those arguments.
No, I'm asking you about the trustee decision. When it refers to respondent in the singular,
yes,
it sometimes is clearly referring to the subsidiaries, and sometimes it's referring to the plan administrator Consol. How do we know whether this award runs just against the plan administrator respondent or whether the trustees thought the plan administrator and subsidiaries were one and the same?
Yeah, I believe that latter to be the case, and I believe the language is well chosen. This is a extraordinarily sophisticated panel.
It may be. This language seems extraordinarily not well chosen.
We think it runs to all parties, the respondents and the subs. If I can get back to Mr. Woodrum's argument here, he gave no reason why this valid arbitration award should be vacated. District court got this spot on. If you read the award, every assertion in it is backed up with reference to the record. Submission, the preliminary injunction hearing, they considered the SPD plans, 120 pages of SPD plans that Consol submitted to them. They also considered whether the changes proposed by Consol plan administrator, would provide the same level of benefits. Ultimately, they decided that was not the case. So,
that's a clarification question. After, now I'm going to go to the district court. Our court has remanded. The parties file a joint
status report,
and they suggest dismissing counterclaims 1 and 2.
That's right.
But instead, the court grants summary judgment on counts 1 and 2, or judgment at least on counts.
Yes, I think it was straight up just dismissal, Your Honor. There was no predicate summary judgment issue, and that's what the court's concerned about. We thought that if you read Judge, and I apologize for going, if you read Judge Nichols' September 30th decision, he makes two key decisions. The dispute was arbitrable, and it drew its essence from the contract. We thought that based on that decision, that issue of arbitrability was foreclosed, was conclusively established.
Apparently, had granted you summary judgment on those counterclaims.
Yes, well. And Mr. Woodrum's counsel on 1 and 2 were that basically the trustees lacked the authority. And the arbitrability determination trumps those arguments. So
my question is more procedural than substantive, but it seems like you jointly suggested a resolution of the case.
Right.
In particular, counts 1 and 2, and then you gave two or three options for counts 3 through 5. One was dismissing with prejudice, one was dismissing without prejudice, ripeness, lack of prosecution.
Prosecution.
Did Judge Nichols agree with your recommendations? Did he go his own way? What happened?
Judge, what happened was in Mr. Woodard, in good faith, certainly the UMWA did, and of course Judge Nichols did. What we were trying to do, the court that was already remanded to them, and he said, gentlemen, give us some ideas here. And we thought that we would try to tailor the case as narrowly as we possibly could. And again, if there's a procedural defect in that, I apologize to the court on behalf of the union. And perhaps the best option is to remand to the judge for some clarification on the concerns raised by the court.
The best option would be to argue that there's nonetheless a final judgment, even if there was a procedural error, because it meets all of our cases that define what a final judgment is.
No, I understand, Judge.
We want to go back and do it again.
Absolutely, Judge. But these are not my concerns, they're the concerns of the court. And if they prevail after our argument today, perhaps that's the way. We think that we have a valid arbitration award. I think it comports entirely with the collective bargaining agreement, the trilogy progeny.
Okay.
And we also believe that we have standing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
Come step up to the microphone, sure.
I'd like to call the court's attention to what I think is very helpful on the question of finality. If the court would look at its own decision in the case of North American Butterfly Association v. Wolf, Judge Millett, I'm sure you're familiar with that case, being on the panel. 977 F 3rd 1244 2020 case. In that case, which involved some of the similar kinds of issues, the court stated, decide whether an order dismissing without prejudice left nothing more for the district court to do, making it final, or instead signal the district court's expectation that the action would continue. And in this case, the order, we think, makes it very clear that Judge Nichols thought and intended that his order disposed of the case. He says this is a final appealable order, and the clerk is directed to terminate the case. So on the finality question, we believe that's really effectively answered by this court's prior decision.
Thank you. All right, with that, the case is submitted.